So judging from yesterday, you won't hesitate to interrupt me, and that's good. So the central question of evolutionary biology has always been to provide a historical explanation for biodiversity. And traditionally, this question has been asked at the taxonomic level. How do we explain the incredible diversity of species that are present on Earth, each remarkably adapted to its conditions of existence? But with the rise of molecular biology and genetics and genomics in the last few decades, we have a whole new level of biodiversity to explain, and that's the biodiversity of genes. Many thousands of genes within each taxon, differing among taxa, each with functions exquisitely optimized, apparently, for its specific functions within the cell or organism. So how do we explain the origin of the biodiversity of genes and their functions? This question, answering it is facilitated by the hierarchical organization of genes within genomes. The vast majority of genes are organized hierarchically in gene families and superfamilies, and that's because they were generated by a serial process of gene duplication and divergence. This means that we can represent the relationships among genes and their history using a phylogeny. The strict analogy between the process of speciation by lineage splitting and divergence and the creation of new genes by gene duplication and divergence means that we can use the techniques of molecular phylogenetics to recover that history. So, are you able to see this behind this thing? Should I move this out of the way? Everybody's fine? Yeah, moving would be good. Is that, now it's bad for you guys, right? Okay, I just saw everybody going like, what the hell? All right. So by recovering the phylogeny of a gene family, this gives us a scaffold on which to understand the historical relationships, date gene duplications, infer the ancestral states at any time during history at the level of function, sequence, or structure, and retrace the process of evolutionary change at all of those levels. Now, I want to talk to you today about how, in my group, we use phylogenetics in combination with the experimental techniques of molecular biology and biochemistry in order to explicitly test hypotheses about the mechanisms of evolutionary processes. Tony Dean and I, in a recent review in Nature Reviews Genetics, called this the functional synthesis. And it allows us to get at really fundamental questions about evolutionary processes that have remained unresolved for decades. Questions like, how does complexity evolve? Is adaptation driven primarily by mutations of large or small effect? What's the role of neutral processes versus selective processes in evolution and adaptation? What's the role of epistasis, which I define here as the dependence of a mutation for its functional effect on the background of states at other sites or loci? Does epistasis make evolution predictable or unpredictable, contingent or deterministic? Does it affect the reversibility of the evolutionary process? And what are the mechanisms for the evolution of new functions? Now, questions like these evolutionary geneticists have been trying to ask for decades, but they have been hindered in these efforts because we've only been able to look at pattern, and we've not been able to directly test hypotheses about the process. All we have are statistical associations, which may be forged by processes other than the ones we think we're seeing signatures of. So all of these questions depend on an understanding of the map that relates changes in sequence to changes in gene function. And it's only in recent times that we've begun to be able to elucidate the nature of that map and thereby understand how changes in sequence produce changes in function. So the functional synthesis as we practice it in my lab involves first phylogenetics to reconstruct the evolutionary history of genes and identify specific sequence changes that occurred at crucial periods during evolution. We then use molecular biology to explicitly and experimentally test those hypotheses that those candidate substitutions were crucial to the evolution of new functions. And we use studies of protein structure to understand the atomic mechanisms by which mutations produce new functions. Now, this approach doesn't have to begin with phylogenetics. It can begin with any approach to identify the candidates. Quantitative genetics, population genetics, if we're working in population genetic time within species, or even within or among populations. It can be used to understand the evolution of any important phenotype. And it offers the possibility of much more decisive scientific inference than we've had previously in evolutionary biology, in my opinion. So I just want to call your attention to what I think is a really beautiful paper by Shozo Yokoyama in PNAS a couple of months ago. He used an approach very much like this to understand the evolution of new functions in opsins of vertebrates. So light-sensitive pigments in the eye, which are adapted to the specific wavelength of light that dominates the organism's environment. And he was able to reconstruct the specific substitutions responsible for the changes in function in several major lineages, first using the phylogenetic approach and then showing that recapitulating those sequence changes in the laboratory recapitulates the evolution of the new function. Now, interestingly, he then went and did the more typical sort of statistical analysis that molecular evolutionary biologists do. He used likelihood-based methods to identify sites that were putatively under positive selection on the branches in question. And then he tested whether those were of functional importance. And it turned out there was absolutely no overlap. None of the sites that had signatures of positive selection did anything to the function. And none of the sites that were responsible historically for the changes in function had the signatures of positive selection. So this speaks to the importance of experimentally testing the statistically generated hypotheses about the evolutionary process. So in my lab, we're interested in a particular kind of function, the evolution of molecular interactions, specific interactions between molecules in the cell. Now, we think this is an important question because cellular functions are driven by specific interactions between molecules. Virtually everything that a living cell does is regulated by specific interactions between transcription factors in their DNA binding sites, between receptors and their ligands, between enzymes and their substrates. These specific interactions are also key to the diversity of genes among genomes. Look at virtually any gene family, and you'll see that they typically have a conserved core function that is shared by all the members. The ability to catalyze some type of reaction, the ability to interact with coactivators that activate transcription. But what varies among the members of the family is the specific partners that they bind to and carry out those operations upon, slightly different substrates, different DNA binding sites, and so on. Despite the incredible importance of these specific molecular interactions in biology and genomics, there's very little known about how they evolve. We have not very well-developed theory and few well-characterized exemplars to understand this process of evolution. It is also a very important question for evolutionary theory in general, because it gets at the question of how do complex systems evolve. Now, the classic model for the evolution of complex systems, of course, is that these systems evolve by a gradual process of optimization and elaboration under the influence of natural selection. And this has been well established, for example, for the evolution of animal eyes from more primitive light-sensing organs, presumably under selection for greater visual acuity. But this explanation seems to break down when we start to look at molecular systems, where the function of any one part depends on its interaction with the other members of the system. They all seem to need to be present before selection can drive a process of optimization. So here's my personal favorite example. This is a vertebrate steroid receptor with its hormone ligand nestled into the pocket here. How do we explain the evolution of a new hormone if there's not already a receptor present to transduce its signal? And conversely, how do we explain the evolution of a new receptor if there's not already a hormone for it to receive? This same problem of how do we get stepwise evolution of a tightly integrated system exists within a protein, because many protein functions, many elements of protein structure depend on multiple mutations that have to work together. So how do these co-adapted alleles within a protein evolve if a single one of those changes in isolation doesn't confer any change or change in function or have any adaptive significance? So, for the origin of an eye, probably. But for the elaboration of an eye from a primitive light-sensing organ to an eye with greater acuity, with a lens and so on, that process has been pretty well reconstructed by looking at various extant forms going through intermediates of greater and greater complexity. The origin is a similar question to the one here. Yeah, you could ask this question at a higher level than just the protein level. Now, Darwin, of course, was well aware of this problem, and he wrote in The Origin, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. And he went on to acknowledge the difficulty of dealing with this challenge. He said, in order to discover the early transitional grades through which the organ has passed, to identify these functional intermediates, we should have to look to very ancient ancestral forms long since become extinct. Now, this challenge is hard enough for morphological characters, but for molecular characters, it has been virtually insurmountable because we seldom, if ever, have good molecular fossils that will give us information about the components of molecular processes within the cell. But happily, in the last decade or less, a new strategy has emerged, combination of computational and biochemical approaches that let us look directly at the ancient ancestral forms of ancient genes. And that's this strategy called ancestral gene resurrection, which we practice in our lab, as you can see here. Ancestral gene resurrection is a multi-step process. It begins with phylogenetics. Given a set of sequences from present-day organisms, we can infer the phylogeny of their relationships to each other. And suppose on this phylogeny we're interested in a specific node on the tree. So suppose here we're interested in this colored node, which would be this gene in the ancestor of all vertebrates. The next thing that we do is to infer the ancestral states by maximum likelihood. And I'll talk about this in more detail in a few minutes. But the essential idea here is that the ancestral state at any node on the tree is the state that has the highest probability of generating all of the states in extant sequences observed today. So we can calculate the likelihood of every possible ancestral state. The likelihood is defined as the probability of giving rise to all of the present-day data that we have, given the tree and an evolutionary model. And the maximum likelihood state is then the one with the highest likelihood. And the maximum likelihood sequence is the string of maximum likelihood states at each site. Given that ancestral peptide sequence, it's not difficult to synthesize a cDNA that codes for that ancestral sequence using biochemical methods, overlap PCR and restriction, digest, and ligation. We used to do this in the lab, now we do it by email. I'm not kidding. This is the easiest part of the process now. And then now that we have the coding sequence, we can express that protein in whatever experimental system is most appropriate, and do molecular biology on it to characterize its function and structure, and experimentally characterize the functions of these ancient proteins. So that's the sort of overview of the process. Now, yeah?
How do you refer to the fact that the maximum likelihood estimate is a sort of point estimate, rather, and there's some uncertainty in those ancestors?
Yeah, so this is a really important question. It's very important to characterize the robustness of a functional inference to uncertainty about the statistical reconstruction. And I'll show you some ways that we've tried to do that. That's the big challenge in this area. This is the part that you can't do by email.
So that's actually an experimental question. So the ancestor cannot be so far away that when you put this protein in one of the current organisms, it will actually clone properly.
Right. So it has to, the protein has to have been conserved enough, and more specifically, the question you have to be asking has to be one about the intrinsic functions of the protein so that the system that you express it in doesn't determine the functions. Right? So when I describe the system we use, ask me that question again if you have doubts about, because that's a really important question. So I'm going to ask questions about functions of a protein that depend to a very limited extent on the cellular background. And to the extent that it does depend on it, those processes have been conserved between the ancestor and the present-day system in which we express it. It's a really good point. So in our lab, we use as a model of a model for this question of how do specific molecular interactions evolve, a gene family called the steroid hormone receptors. So steroid hormone receptors are fundamentally molecular mediators. They are all about interactions. Their functions depend on their specific interactions with other molecules. So here's a cartoon of how a typical steroid hormone receptor works. So the hormones are fat soluble. They're metabolites of cholesterol. So they're produced in glands like the gonads or the adrenal glands, and they circulate in the blood to target tissues throughout the body. At the target tissues, because they're fat soluble, they can diffuse through cell membranes. The receptor is typically in the cytosol, in the absence of hormone, and it is in an inactive conformation. The hormone and the receptor bind to each other with remarkably high affinity. So it only takes the equivalent of a few drops of testosterone in a railroad car of serum, so we're in the low nanomolar, high picomolar range here, a few drops in a railroad car to yield the phenotypic difference between a typical adult male and female vertebrate, or you add a few more drops and you get Arnold Schwarzenegger. Okay. So very high affinity and very specific interaction here. This binding event of the ligand to the receptor changes the conformation of the receptor. And that change in conformation allows the receptor to go into the nucleus, to bind a specific DNA response element. These are 15 base pair sequences with a conserved motif for each receptor or subset of receptors, and they bind as dimers. The crucial thing about this active conformation is that it exposes a surface on the protein that coactivator proteins in the nucleus bind to. And these coactivators will modify chromatin or otherwise attract the basal transcription machinery or in some other way upregulate the expression of a target gene that's flanked by this response element. So ligand binds, conformation changes, bind DNA, expose the surface for the coactivator. Now that's really embarrassing when your phone rings during a talk. That is really embarrassing. Should I be like Rudy Giuliani and answer it? Did you see that when he did that during his primary campaign? And it was his wife. This was probably my wife. I think he was talking to the National Rifle Association when he did it. All right. So these are, their function is determined by their ability to specifically recognize a ligand, specifically recognize DNA sequences, and also interact with coactivator proteins. They play crucial biological functions. The ligands for them include estrogens, androgens like testosterone, stress hormone cortisol, progesterone, which is its classic function is the maintenance of pregnancy. Because of their biological importance, they're also biomedically important. Estrogen receptors, for example, are the major mediator of breast cancer risk. It's the number one identified risk factor is exposure to estrogens and their actions through the estrogen receptor. Because of this biological and biomedical importance, there's a huge database of structure function information, which gives us a rich context in which to interpret evolutionary information. And finally, there are convenient assays of their intrinsic function, and this goes to the question you were asking. So nuclear receptors, steroid receptors are members of a larger superfamily called nuclear receptors, and they have a conserved domain structure. It's a modular structure consisting of two domains that are very well conserved. The DNA binding domain is a zinc finger region, which recognizes and binds to DNA. The ligand binding domain is a largely helical region. This binds the ligand, changes conformation, and exposes the coactivator surface. So this region is responsible for the ligand-mediated changes in gene expression. Now the last helix is called the activation function helix because that's the part that's repositioned when the ligand is bound and creates the surface for coactivators to bind. And we'll talk about that more later. So this modular structure means that we can mix and match DNA binding domains with ligand binding domains and create chimeric receptors which maintain the DNA binding function of one receptor with the ligand binding function of another.
Activates, it gets taken into the nucleus as well?
Yes, so that depends on the specific receptor. Some receptors are in the cytosol without the ligand. Some are actually in the nucleus without the ligand, but are unable to activate transcription until the ligand is there. Okay. That's variable among members of the family.
So presumably there'll be some co-evolution also between being brought into the nucleus as well as...
The mechanisms of that process of nuclear transport for the ones that do go back and forth are not well understood. So that's kind of a black box. So here's the background on the family. There are six members of this subfamily in you and me. We have two estrogen receptors, alpha and beta, which have very similar functions. They both recognize estrogens, estradiol as the primary estrogen in humans. Then there are two other pairs. There's the androgen receptor, testosterone is its primary ligand, and the progesterone receptor, progesterone is its primary ligand. And then the other pair are less famous than those guys. The glucocorticoid receptor is activated by the stress hormone cortisol, and the mineralocorticoid receptor is activated by a hormone called aldosterone, which regulates salt and water balance, osmolarity in your body. So in our lab, our goal is to understand how this diversity of ligand steroid receptor interactions evolved from a single common ancestor before there were any gene duplications to yield the diversity we see today. So the family evolved through a series of gene duplications, each one marked here. You need a gene duplication to generate each pair of receptors. Here is the ancestral steroid receptor at the base of the whole family. We want to understand this and reconstruct the entire process of diversification. But today, I'm going to talk to you in detail about our work on one sister pair of receptors, the GR and the MR, which evolved from a common ancestor, which we call the ancestral corticosteroid receptor. Both of these ligands are produced in the adrenal glands. And the class of hormones is called corticosteroids because they're produced in the adrenal cortex.
Okay.
So we want to understand how these ligand specificities, cortisol with the JR, ELDO with the MR, evolved from this common ancestral CR. So a little bit of background on the players. The GR's primary ligand is cortisol, and it regulates the long-term response to stress, including changes in glucose homeostasis, fat metabolism, changes in behavior, and so on. The MR is regulated by different hormones depending on the taxonomic lineage. So in tetrapods, it's activated by aldosterone. Only tetrapods make aldosterone. So in teleosts, the other major lineage that has the MR, it's activated by a similar hormone called deoxycorticosterone, or DOC. And it regulates osmolarity, so its major targets are colon and kidney function, blood pressure, behavior, and so on. So notice the structural similarity between the ligands. The differences are very subtle. They are all built on this common steroid backbone structure, and they differ only in a few positions. Here are the differences. Both aldosterone and cortisol have a hydroxyl group at the 11 position, which is lacking from DOC. Cortisol has a hydroxyl group at the 17 position. Neither ELDO or DOC has that. So we're going to talk a lot about that 17 hydroxyl because it's crucial to the specificity of the GR for cortisol. And then finally, ELDO has a distinguishing characteristic. It has one more oxygen, a hydroxyl group here at the 18 position, which is lacking from any of the other hormones. So the changes in structure that are required to recognize these different hormones are likely to be quite subtle. So how do we get this from the ancestral CR? One more piece of information you need. The aldosterone is a recently evolved hormone. We do know something already about its evolutionary history. Aldosterone is present only in tetrapods. It is not found in teleosts. It's not found in cartilaginous fish like skates, sharks, and rays. It's not found in jawless fish like lampreys and hagfish. Now, aldosterone is at the end of biochemical pathway. Its evolution occurred by elaboration of this pathway, adding one more step at the end. So its production goes from progesterone as an intermediate through DOC as an intermediate. Then DOC is converted into corticosterone or deoxycortisol by an enzyme called CYP11B, and all of the reactions that are marked with a star here are catalyzed by the same enzyme. But it's only in tetrapods that this enzyme, same enzyme, can catalyze hydroxylation at the 18 position. So the teleost enzyme, for example, this enzyme, same enzyme, can't do this. It stops right here. So we therefore know that aldosterone is a recent evolutionary novelty in the tetrapod lineage, which evolved by modification of this enzyme to give it a new activity, adding a step, adding a new terminal hormone to the step. Okay, so that knowledge has led people to believe that the partnership of the MR with aldosterone is recent, because aldosterone is a recent hormone. It's been assumed, therefore, that the MR's affinity for aldosterone is also a recent novelty, which brings us back to that question we started with: how do you get a new hormone unless the receptor is already there? How do you get a new receptor if there's not already the hormone? That hypothesis really raises a difficult question. So we wanted to understand this. We wanted to test this hypothesis that the MR sensitivity for aldosterone is derived and understand the mechanisms by which it evolved. So that involves going back to the ancestor. This ancestor existed more than 450 million years ago. So we are definitely not in population genetic time here. We're in fairly deep phylogenetic time. This is in the ancestor. This is in deep in the vertebrate lineage before your common ancestor with a salmon. So what we want to do is reconstruct and characterize the function of this ancestor. Now, something you should know about the process of ancestral reconstruction, the statistical confidence and error rate in the reconstruction depend on the lengths of the branches that surround the node that you want to reconstruct. And given the sequences that were available at the time, a few of these branches surrounding the ancestral CR were a little bit long. So we first thing we wanted to do was to break up those branches by cloning and sequencing new members of the family that would go along those branches. So we concentrated on these taxa. First, we wanted to get the MR and GR of elasmobranchs. And we also wanted to get the corticosteroid receptors of jawless fish, which branch off before this event. So we cloned and characterized receptors from this lovely guy, the Atlantic hagfish, and this even prettier fella, the sea lamprey. So these are jawless fish. And they each have one unduplicated corticosteroid receptor. So we have the sequences now, and the first thing we wanted to do was to characterize their functions. So these are the extant receptors from the jawless fish. Here's the assay. It's a very standard assay in molecular endocrinology. This is we do it in several different types of mammalian cells. We always get the same result. We transfect in a fusion construct containing the Galfor DNA binding domain. This is the DNA binding domain of a transcription factor in yeast, which is fused to the ligand binding domain of the corticosteroid receptor that we're interested in. We co-transfect that with a reporter consisting of a luciferase gene flanked by a UAS element, which is the binding site for the Gal4 DBD. So these proteins are expressed, the Gal4 DBD binds the UAS element, we throw different hormones in various doses at the system. If the hormone activates the receptor, luciferase is expressed in a quantitative fashion, and we can measure the activity in a luminometer. So here is the response of the hagfish and lamprey CRs in black and gray, respectively, to a panel of steroid hormones. You can see that estrogens and progesterones are poor activators, as are androgens, but all of the corticosteroids are good ligands, including, surprisingly, aldosterone, despite the fact that these guys don't make aldosterone. Now, this is a high dose. This is a super physiological dose. So what's really important is the sensitivity, which we get at using a dose response analysis. So this is a log molar scale of increasing dose of hormone versus fold increase in luciferase activity compared to vehicle-only control. And you can see that these are exquisitely sensitive aldosterone receptors, aldosterone in black. These receptors are better receptors for aldosterone than they are for the stress hormone cortisol. In this sense, they look much more like MRs than GRs. The human MR, for example, is very sensitive to aldosterone and has some sensitivity to cortisol, but weakly so. Interestingly, so does that from fish, even though these guys don't make aldosterone either. That's in contrast to the way GRs look. GRs are very bad aldosterone receptors, little or no response to aldosterone, and they are decent cortisol receptors. So surprisingly, these basal vertebrates have MR-like receptors, and so do those from the cartilaginous fish. Both their MR and their GR prefer aldosterone to cortisol. Not what we expected if aldosterone sensitivity is a derived feature of the MRs of tetrapods. So this, when we plot this functional information on the phylogeny, we see something that's different from what we started with. So here's the phylogeny of the gene family. This is a reduced version of the phylogeny. This one is generated using a database of 60 sequences, amino acids, because it's such a deep phylogeny. We've repeated the analysis now with 210 sequences, a much enlarged database, because there's been a lot more sequencing recently. And it doesn't change the phylogeny at all. So what we've done on here, oh, and I should also mention that we get the same phylogeny irrespective of the method we use. We can use Bayesian methods, maximum likelihood, or maximum parsimony, all give us the same topology. So what I've done on here is plot in blue all of the receptors that are sensitive to aldosterone, and in red the receptors which are GR-like in that they're cortisol receptors but don't respond to aldosterone. And here's the ancestor. If we were to just reconstruct, to predict the ancestral function by parsimony, this ancestor, that's my wife calling you.
I wish you'd
smoke. Me too. This is going to be on the web, isn't it? So if we were to reconstruct this ancestor by parsimony, this would be an aldosterone-sensitive receptor. Because if this were red, if this were aldosterone-insensitive, we would have to have independent gains of aldosterone sensitivity in this lineage, and in that lineage, all in the absence of the hormone, which seems quite unlikely. So the new hypothesis now is going to be that the ancestor was MR-like, aldosterone-sensitive. So we want to test that hypothesis using ancestral sequence reconstruction. So here's the quick lesson in how this works. Here's the simplest possible tree, an ancestor with one descendant. The descendant has an A. I'm going to talk about DNA sequences here because talking about four states is a lot easier than talking about 20 states. The extant sequence has an A. We want to know what the ancestor had. We can calculate the likelihood that the ancestor X had state I for any state. The likelihood is defined as the probability of the data, that is, an extant A, given that the ancestor had state I, and assuming a certain topology, not much of a topology, a certain evolutionary model, which tells us about the relative rates of change from any one state to another state, and the parameters of that model. So for instance, one key parameter of this model is going to be, or one set of parameters, is going to be the elements of the transition matrix that tells you the relative rates of going from A to C, G, and T, or from C to A, G, and T, etc. Now, we could fill this matrix with any number of independent parameters. The simplest model, they're all the same. That's the Jukes-Kanner model. Here's the Chimera 80 model, which has two rates, one for transitions and one for transversions. Another important parameter is the branch length. This is really the crucial one in this case. The branch length is expressed as the probability of substitution per site, or the mean number of substitutions expected over sites between the ancestor and the descendant. So now, given information like this, a model, the parameters of the model and the length of the branches, we can calculate the result of a Markov chain the probability of getting A from any ancestral state at X. So if we use the simplest model, Jukes-Kanner model, which is unbiased of going from any one state to another one, and given this branch length, the likelihood of getting an A, if you started with an A, is 0.9064. Notice that it's a little bit higher than 0.9 because 1/10, you expect on average a substitution 1/10 of the time, but that means there's a low probability of having double substitutions, which will send you from A to something else and then back to A. So the probability of getting an A starting from an A is a little bit higher than 90%. And then the rest of the probability comes from all of the other possible ancestral states. And because the model is unbiased, I'm using Jukes-Kanner here, all those other ones are equal. If we used a K80 model, then going from an ancestral G to an A would have higher probability than going from an ancestral C or T to A. Okay? So that's the simplest case. We simply scale that up and use joint likelihoods when we're talking about a tree. So here's the next simplest possible tree, an ancestor with two descendants and branch lengths. Again, I'm using Jukes-Kanner here. The likelihood of any ancestral state here is the probability of getting a G here and a C here, given that ancestral state, which is the product of the likelihoods from the ancestral state to G along this branch and the ancestral state here going to C along this branch. So it's just the product. That's shown here. These are the likelihoods. And now that we know the likelihoods of getting the extant data from any ancestral state. We can also calculate the posterior probability in a sort of empirical Bayesian framework. This is simply that defined as the likelihood of any ancestral state is its likelihood divided by the sum of the likelihoods for all ancestral states. So what fraction of the total likelihood, the probability of getting these states, comes from each ancestral state? Yeah? And in this case, the probability of getting G and C is highest from an ancestral G. Posterior probability is 80%. And that makes sense because going from a G to a G on a short branch and a G to a C on a long branch is going to be higher than any than the probability of getting these data given any other ancestral state. Okay? And given a whole tree, we can just scale up that process. So we calculate the likelihood at any internal node, which is defined as the probability of getting all of the data on the tree given that the state at that node. Okay? And this shows you that there will often be some uncertainty. We're 80% certain that this is a G, or we're 93% certain that this is an A, but there are other possibilities. Yeah?
Are the sequence alignments you use completely gap-free?
They're not gap-free, but the alignment of the ligand binding domain is pretty unambiguous. So there are a couple places where there have been indels, but it's clear where they go.
But you do this method with... Like you're given the tree and you're not questioning that, the alignment, and you're not questioning that, and just infer the ancestor state given the alignment.
Yeah, so that's a good point. In our case with these receptors, there's not ambiguity that's introduced by uncertainty about the alignment. But you can imagine cases where there would be, and then you would want to characterize robustness not only to uncertainty about the ancestral state, but uncertainty about the alignment itself. Yeah, that's a good point. That's true in general. That's an underappreciated aspect of phylogenetic analysis, I think. People are always talking about, oh, there's a very high confidence in this node, given the model, and maybe they'll look at other models. But it's much less common to examine robustness over alignments, and my suspicion is, from working with some other gene families, that that's probably a greater source of uncertainty, and it's really not adequately appreciated, I think. Okay? All right, so we reconstruct the ancestral corticosteroid receptor on that phylogeny that I showed you. It's the maximum likelihood phylogeny. And we want to determine the maximum likelihood ancestral CR sequence. This requires selection of a model. We selected the model using a Bayesian method that examines a large set of possible models, and it turns out that one model, the JTT model, which is an empirically derived model of the probability of going from any one amino acid state to any other amino acid state from a huge database of proteins, together with a gamma distribution of a Munk site rate variation, had 100% posterior probability in that Bayesian analysis. So we assumed this for the ancestral sequence reconstruction. And what I've shown here is a histogram of the posterior probabilities over sites of the ancestral reconstruction. And you can see that the vast majority of sites are reconstructed with essentially no ambiguity. But there are a smaller number of sites that there is quite a bit of uncertainty about. There are alternate states which have non-trivial posterior probabilities, and we're going to come back to these guys later. Keep them in mind, because an ancestral characterization of an ancestral gene is only as good as the confidence in the sequence reconstruction itself. Okay, so let's look in a little bit of detail at the sequence. When we look across the entire ligand binding domain, which is 232 sites, and the mean posterior probability over sites is 0.94, this shows the amino acid sequence identity to a number of present-day descendants. The blue ones are aldosterone sensitive, and the red ones are aldosterone insensitive. These are the GR-like receptors, the cortisol receptors. And you can see that the ancestor is a little bit more similar to the MRs than to the GR. But it's not very impressive. When we look at the residues that line the ligand binding pocket, however, based on crystal structures of present-day receptors, the pattern gets stronger. So here we have 23 sites, very strongly supported reconstruction, almost identical ancestor to the present-day aldosensitive receptors, and considerably greater difference to the aldosterone insensitive receptor. So this is consistent with the idea that this receptor is going to be aldosterone sensitive, but what we really want to do is test that hypothesis. So we do the exact same assay that I showed you for the lamprey and the hagfish and the skate on the reconstructed ancestral receptor. This shows you the dose response curves for all three hormones. And this is an exquisitely sensitive aldosterone and DOC receptor. It looks just like an MR. We measure sensitivity as the EC50, the effective concentration 50. This is the dose of hormone required to give half maximal activation. So here's maximal activation. This is the EC50. It's the point at which half maximal activation is achieved. So there's the EC50 for aldo, for DOC, and here's cortisol. Okay. This sensitivity makes it comparable to the human MR. Now I'm going to, because dose response curves are sort of annoying to look at, I'm often going to express these same sorts of data in a bar graph. I'm going to show the EC50 on the y-axis, and because this is negative, remember a low EC50 means more sensitive. It takes less hormone to give you half maximal activation. A bigger bar means more sensitive. So green is a good ligand, orange is a good ligand, purple is not as good a ligand. Okay? So this indicates, corroborates our hypothesis, that the ancestral function was MR-like, that sensitivity to aldosterone is extremely ancient, not derived. This conclusion is robust to uncertainty about the reconstruction. If you remember those ambiguously reconstructed states, for every site that had an alternate reconstruction with posterior probability greater than 0.2, we introduced that alternate state into the maximum likelihood ancestor and repeated this assay. And in no case did it change the sensitivity to aldosterone. It's also robust to phylogenetic uncertainty. So that tree that the reconstruction was based upon was well supported, but there were a few soft nodes that were not so well supported, indicating that there are other possible topologies that could be true. The reconstruction assumes, however, that the maximum likelihood tree was true, so we want to characterize the robustness to this form of uncertainty. So what we did was we used the Bayesian method to assemble a very large collection of plausible trees with posterior probability greater than 0.00002. And from that large set, we assembled the 95% credible set of phylogenies. There were 487 trees in that credible set. We then statistically reconstructed the ancestor on all 487 trees, and we found that only one site was variable for the maximum likelihood reconstruction across different trees. That one site that depended on which tree we assumed, we then introduced by mutagenesis into this ancestor and found that it had no effect on the function. So from that we conclude that the ancestor was activated by aldosterone and had MR-like functions. Okay, so here we go. Yeah.
So do you want to conclude that aldosterone was in the ancestor?
I want to conclude that the receptor was sensitive to aldosterone before the hormone existed.
Oh, before the hormone.
Yeah.
So for example, the LAC repressor is more sensitive to IPTG than...
Exactly.
I was just going to say, maybe another expression of how robust the ancestral sequence reconstruction is some kind of statement on how many equally likely sequences there are that would... is there some way of saying that there are equally likely sequences that may be functionally equivalent, but.
There are no equally likely sequences. This is the maximum likelihood sequence.
Okay. So you can't say that another sequence is, you know, there were some sites were less resolvable, right?
That's right. Some were less.
But it still doesn't, you wouldn't be able to find another sequence that changes in these unresolvable sites would not affect the total likelihood of the sequence.
So the sequences that have the alternate states have lower likelihood because the alternate state has a lower likelihood than the maximum likelihood state.
Okay.
We were checking to see if those states that have lower but non-trivial likelihood affected the function.
I see.
So one other methods question, I guess, is did you look at the sensitivity of the ancestral states to the model and other ways of estimating parameters like partitioning? Because you had sort of the two different protein regions and maybe they're under very different, evolving very differently.
Yeah, that's a good point. This is just for the LBD. The reconstruction is, the parameters of the model are optimized just for the LBD.
Oh, just for the LBD.
Yeah. And the model itself is fixed because it's JTT, it's a protein model. So there aren't many free parameters in the model. The branch lengths come from the LBD analysis. We didn't look at other protein models. You know, we didn't look at WAG and Dayhoff and all that because they had zero posterior probability in the Bayesian analysis, so we didn't do it.
So on average, how many sites do you have wrong? So you have a probability of each site being wrong, and you can ask how many sites you have wrong on average in the ancestors. You're doing single sites?
That's right. We didn't do the combinations because there's too damn many. I mean, it's just not tractable. So
how many would you, so you can say on average we'll have one site wrong, in mm-hmm. which case the single site replacement increase.
So the mean posterior probability was 94%.
Yeah. And how long was it?
And it's 232, so about 15 on average.
Actually many combinations which are
quite right.
Likely.
So none of those ambiguous sites do anything on their own. I suppose it's possible that in combination they might switch the function. It's possible. We can't rule it out strictly.
But I guess you know that the present A species all have this kind of response. Which
exactly.
Gives you hope that the ancestor
right. So the fact that the sort of orthogonal information of what the present-day species have is completely congruent with this evidence adds a lot of strength to the inference.
Was there a difference between synonymous and non-synonymous sites in terms of what was ambiguous?
So this is all protein sequence.
Yeah.
It's too long ago to do DNA sequences.
So in some sense, you ignore 17 synonymous sites, as in just trying to reconstruct them.
Right.
Where these uncertain sites are in the structure, so they might be in places which are obviously not very important.
Yeah, well, this is a good question. So generally, the uncertainty is going to come at sites which are flickering on and off among different states. So they have to be, that's the only way to get uncertainty. So they're under less functional constraints anyway. Generally, it doesn't surprise me that the uncertain states are not functionally important because they weren't conserved. When we look at them on the structure, they're mostly on the surface. And a lot of them are ambiguity between two biochemically similar states. You know, between a D and an E, or a K and an R, or you know, an I and an L. So it's the pattern appears to be that uncertainty. You would predict from looking at the patterns that the uncertain states would probably not change the function, and then when we do the experiment with them, they didn't.
Okay.
Right.
So what's the receptor binding?
Yeah, so what the hell is going on? Okay. So this gives us an answer to that problem of which comes first, the hormone or the receptor, and how did the system evolve? So if we plot this on the tree, we start out with in the ancestor of all vertebrates, a single unduplicated corticosteroid receptor, which is sensitive to all three hormones, just as present-day MRs are. Then you get a gene duplication after the jawless fish branch off, giving you separate GRs and MRs. After the cartilaginous fish branch off, this is where the GR loses its sensitivity to aldosterone, loses the ancestor's sensitivity to aldo and to DOC, as we'll see. And then it's only later that aldosterone appears in the tetrapod lineage. So the receptor is sensitive to aldo long before aldo exists. So we call this molecular exploitation. It indicates that the hormone comes after the receptor in a stepwise fashion. The receptor's sensitivity to the ligand preceded the synthesis of the ligand. We call this exploitation because a newly evolved hormone through the elaboration of that pathway recruited an ancient receptor into a new signaling complex. So this is recruitment or exploitation for a new function. But it raises the question, what was this ancestral receptor? Why was it sensitive to aldosterone tens of millions of years before the hormone comes around? And so it looks like the receptor was somehow pre-adapted to bind aldosterone when aldosterone came along. There's a sort of teleology in that language that I don't really like, but it had a capacity to bind aldosterone before the hormone appeared. Now that sensitivity has to be a byproduct of its affinity for its native hormone, the same way IPTG is a better ligand for Lexi. Is that what it? Yeah. So we think the ancestral hormone is likely to be DOC. It's produced in all vertebrates. The enzymes for its synthesis are at least as old as the ancestral CR. It remains the physiological ligand for the MR in teleosts today. And it's a good ligand for all of the descendants of the ancestral CR, except for the GRs, which have lost it. So the hypothesis then is that activation by aldosterone would be a structural byproduct of the receptor sensitivity to DOC, just as the lamprey and hagfish receptors can still be activated, can be activated by aldosterone, even though those guys don't make the hormone. So it would be because of an intrinsic promiscuity in the receptor. Now that's a structural hypothesis, and so it requires a structural test. So we generated the first crystal structure of an ancient protein in collaboration with a structural biologist at Emory University, Eric Ortlund. So we overexpress that reconstructed ancestor, crystallize it, and do X-ray crystallography on it at the Advanced Photon Source at Argonne, looking like it's either being blessed or cursed by the deity here. And we have very high resolution structure of the ancestral LBD with aldosterone in the pocket. This is the classic steroid receptor active conformation with the activation function helix in its active position. And the overall conformation is extremely similar to that of the human MR 450 million years later. You can see very, very small difference between the two, and remarkably, they're even the same color. Now, we actually have the crystal structure of the ancestral receptor with all three ligands done independently, and this shows you the ancestral ligand pocket. These are the side chains of the residues that make contact with the ligand. The three structures are superimposed here. You can see each side chain has three in different shades of gray. These are for the three different structures. And then the hormones are superimposed on each other with the color key here. There are two take-home messages from this image. The first one is that the receptor binds the three hormones in exactly the same fashion. It doesn't have to it doesn't have to adjust the position of the backbone or the rotamers in any way to accommodate the three different hormones. And then the second message is that the two additional oxygens which are found on aldosterone compared to DOC, the 11 and the 18 oxygens, there is ample room for them to be accommodated in the ancestral ligand pocket. There's quite a bit of room up here above the ligand for these to fit in the ancestral structure. So aldosterone can fortuitously fit into the receptor, and this creates an evolutionary potential that was then exploited when aldosterone evolved later due to elaboration of the biosynthetic pathway.
One of the three was not a good, for one of the three, I think was cortisol was not a good receptor.
Cortisol is not as good.
Why?
So the difference for cortisol is the 17-hydroxyl down here. This is what it has that nobody else has. And there's a little bit of a clash between this hydroxyl and this side chain here. It's not prohibitive, but it reduces the affinity. That's a good question. Okay. All right, so that's part one. Do you want to take a break now?
Yeah.
Let's do that.
How did that specificity come up? So the first thing we need to do is identify exactly when the change in function occurred. So we resurrected and functionally characterized successive ancestors moving up the tree. So this is the data that you've already seen, the ancestral CR. Next thing we did was reconstruct and experiment with the ancestral GR1, which is the ancestral GR in the common ancestor of you and a shark. This is the ancestral jawed vertebrate. And it is still promiscuous. It is activated by all three hormones. So then we move on to the ancestral GR2, which is the GR in the ancestor of you and a tuna. So this is about what, 440 million? This is 410 million years ago or so, based on the fossil record. And this one is totally GR-like. It's activated only by cortisol. Its activation by aldosterone and DOC has been eliminated. So we want to understand the mechanistic basis for that shift in function.
Sorry, can I ask what's biologically realistic on this?
So cortisol is unique in that it's the only hormone that's present in fairly high doses. So this is in the physiological range for tetrapods and T-Rexes. And these levels are realistic for these ones.
Do you have an idea how the elastomer
behaves? Yes. So that's in a paper in NBE. Right now it's in advanced access and NDE. The elasmobranch GR is activated by all three hormones, but it's less sensitive to all of them.
So it's similar to that ancestral one?
If you take these and you move them up to here, that's what it's like. So this indicates that the change in function occurs during this interval, and the mutations that are candidates for having conferred this new function are the changes that happen between GR1 and GR2. Unfortunately, there are 36 substitutions plus deletion, which is too damn many to analyze experimentally in any sort of combination. So we used the phylogenetic pattern to come up with a subset of candidates.
Yeah. Are you still talking about amino acid substitutions?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's never Yeah,
but I'm claiming that the ancestor one is better, has less substitution than ancient GR2. I don't understand.
I'm sorry, ask again?
So I don't understand why the reconstruction that you were able to do to the ancestor CR has had less substitution and
uncertainty.
Yeah.
The reconstruction. So these are all quite robust. They're good.
Yeah.
There were fewer ambiguous sites here than there were in these two. These two are about the same. And we did the same sort of analysis on them in terms of the alternate states as we did with the sample.
Okay.
So what we're talking about is the difference between this sequence and this sequence. And there's a lot, too many. But we use the phylogenetic pattern to identify a subset of plausible candidates. And this was to look for positions in the sequence that were diagnostic, in the sense that they're conserved in one state in all of the GR-like receptors, and in a different state in all of the MR-like receptors. And there were five of them. So those five become our candidates. And we're going to introduce those into the ancestral receptor and determine their effect and function and see if we can recapitulate the evolution of the GR from the ancestral receptor. So here, I'm going to show you the results on this plot of sensitivity space. So along the x-axis is the EC50 for aldosterone, sensitivity to aldosterone. It's a log scale. Remember, a low EC50 is very sensitive. Along this axis is sensitivity to cortisol. So receptors that are sensitive to both ligands are in this zone, like the human MR and the ancestral CR. And the GRs are out here, insensitive to aldosterone, but retain sensitivity to cortisol, though with less quantitative sensitivity. So we're looking for substitutions that are going to get us from this zone over to this zone. So we tried each of those candidate substitutions individually. Oh, and I'll mention that each dot is the EC50, and the radius of the circle is the magnitude of activation. So each of the singles, they don't do what we want them to do. So this receptor is close to dead, this one doesn't go where we want, and this is a pretty much worthless receptor. Nothing gives us a good cortisol receptor. So then we tried the doubles, the twofold combinations. And most of these don't do the job either, except there's one combination. This is at sites 106 and 111 in the ligand binding domain. That get us into the zone that we want. Three orders of magnitude reduction in sensitivity to aldosterone, and cortisol sensitivity almost exactly the same as the present day rodent GR. So these two are sufficient to switch the preference from preferring aldosterone and DOC to preferring cortisol. But if we need two substitutions, it raises the question of how we get there. So here's the ancestral GR1, and here's the double mutant. So it prefers cortisol to the other hormones. But how do we get there? There are two ways. We can have S106P first or L111Q first. And if we go through S106P first, we have a deleterious effect on function with any of the hormones. So this is a several orders of magnitude reduction in sensitivity to the hormones. And all of these are well above physiological concentrations. So this is likely to be a non-functional receptor. This intermediate, an evolutionary trajectory through this intermediate seems quite unlikely, based on the idea that evolution through sequence space should move among functional places in sequence space. So what if we go, what if this substitution happens first? Interestingly, this substitution is functionally neutral. It has a negligible effect on function, doesn't make it worse, doesn't really make it better, has no change in specificity. But once this substitution is in place, then we can introduce S106P and not lose the function. And in fact, it's in this background, S106P shifts the preference. So now we have a receptor that prefers cortisol to the other hormones, just like the modern day GR does. So it doesn't get us all the way there. But these two substitutions alone are sufficient to switch the function. And we can say that it is much more likely that evolution took this pathway than this pathway because of the strong epistatic interaction between the two substitutions. So the next thing we wanted to know was how those two substitutions switch the preference, what the atomic basis for that is, and why there's this epistatic interaction between them, why you need both of them. So we've now generated the crystal structure of GR2 as well, that ancestral GR-like receptor. And we can compare the structure of the receptor before and after the mutations.
So you say that you need this two mutations makes this move. But is that more parsimonious than saying that you need to have three mutations? You could have two neutral steps and then a third, one which changed the function. So you have five diagnostic mutations on that lineage?
I'll show you the other three in a minute.
Okay.
So right now I just want to understand the atomic basis, the structural basis for how those two affect the function. And we'll work the other three in there. So here are those two sites on the ancestral backbone. So there's a leucine at this 111 position, which is, it's farther from the hormone than it looks in three dimensions. It's actually further. The serine 106 is down here at the base of the helix that leucine 111 is on. And serine 106 forms a hydrogen bond here, which is stabilizing this helix in its position along the ligand pocket. This is cortisol in the pocket, and this is the 17-hydroxyl that is only found on cortisol. So this is that unique sort of distinguishing ligand for cortisol. In the GR2, these change so that we now have a polar side chain of glutamine here at 111. And serine becomes proline down here at the base of the helix. Proline does something quite radical to the conformation. Proline induces kinks in the helix. And that kink is going to pull down this helix. It's going to unwind the bottom of the helix, pull the whole helix down, and reposition this site 111. And once that 111 is moved, it'll be right next to the 17-hydroxyl group, and the polar substitution here is going to form a hydrogen bond to that 17-hydroxyl, which is unique to cortisol. So let me show you now what these substitutions look like on the backbone of GR2. So what you have is a kink introduced by the S106P mutation. In isolation, this destabilizes the structure of the receptor because if this is still a leucine, you get no hydrogen bond here. And if you change the leucine to glutamine when it's still up here, it doesn't do anything. However, once it's down here, this polar substitution allows the receptor to form a hydrogen bond to cortisol, but it only forms into cortisol. So now the receptor is destabilized with aldosterone and DOC because it lacks this essential 17-hydroxyl group. Therefore, the two in combination destabilize the receptor and restore sensitivity to cortisol alone because of this new interaction with the 17-hydroxyl. Okay? So we call this conformational epistasis. The epistasis is due to the fact that one substitution repositions the other site in three-dimensional space so that a mutation at this site now differs in function depending on the background at this site. Okay. So now I want to ask the question of how we get all the way to the GR phenotype. We mentioned that the double mutant prefers cortisol to the other ligands, but it's not GR-like yet. It hasn't completely lost its LDO and DOC sensitivity. So how do we optimize the specificity for GR? Our hypothesis was that those other three are required to get us to the fine. So to test that hypothesis, we're going to put all five substitutions in together, add the three new ones to the two that we already changed. And I'm going to introduce a little terminology here so I don't have to talk about five substitutions at once. Group X is the two we've already looked at, and group Y are the three others. This hydrophobic site here, this hydrophobic site here, and then a deletion at site 212. That's a three base pair deletion to take out one of the ones. Okay, so here's the dose response curve for the double mutant that we just looked at. And the hypothesis is that when we look at the XY mutant, that this is now going to be cortisol specific. So we introduce those and it's completely worthless. This is essentially a dead receptor. Now this is very surprising because these five substitutions occurred 400 some million years ago and have been conserved in every GR since then. So this is a very unlikely evolutionary pathway to have gone through this combination. And it means there must have been additional allostatic substitutions, modifiers of group Y, that allow the receptor to tolerate these substitutions. So we want to know what those are. And to identify these additional modifiers that we hope will get us all the way to the GR phenotype, we looked at the structure. So here's the comparison of the GR1 structure to the GR2 structure, and these having different functions have different colors. Here's what you need to know as background. The active conformation depends on the stability of this activation function helix. If this thing is flopping around, then the interaction with coactivators is weak and you get a poor activator. Now that stability depends on a network of hydrogen bonds and packing interactions between the activation function helix 3, between the activation function helix 3, the ligand, this other helix back here, and helix 7. This is the helix that move, that has the S106P and L111Q on them. So there's this whole network of interactions that determines the function of the receptor. So we looked at the group Y substitutions and tried to understand how they would affect function. And it turns out that they all destabilize aspects of this network, but contribute to this interaction with the 17-hydroxyl group that's unique to cortisol. And very briefly, I'll show you how. The first one is this deletion of the serine at 212. The serine at 212 forms a hydrogen bond to the loop right before the activation function helix, stabilizing its position here. The deletion gets rid of that hydrogen bond and increases the mobility up here and makes it a less stable receptor in the active conformation. The other two are at the bottom of the ligand pocket near this repositioned helix. And one of them actually forms a hydrogen bond with the 17-hydroxyl group, but both of them open up extra space under the ligand. And that extra space means that that network of interactions is less strong. So what we predict is if the receptor could tolerate these three substitutions, it would be more cortisol specific, but it can't tolerate them because they're too destabilizing. So our prediction is that these modifiers that we're looking for are going to stabilize the specific parts of the structure that are destabilized by group Y. So we looked at at all of the other substitutions that are left, the 37 minus 5 that we've already got here, and it turned out that there were two that had an interesting pattern for two reasons. First, they're conserved in all the GRs. They're not conserved in the MRs, the way X and Y were, but they are conserved in one state in all the GRs, variable among the MRs. And second, they are in places on the structure that suggest they're going to help compensate for the loss of stability. Specifically, at site 26, switching from an asparagine so a 3-amine here is going to give a new hydrogen bond to that same loop where the hydrogen bond was lost from, but it's at a different place on the loop. And the second one from this hydrophilic to a hydrophobic side chain at the in the loop at the bottom of helix 7 improves the packing interactions between the loop before helix 7 and the bottom of the ligand pocket. So we thought that this would restabilize the destabilized helix 7. So these are our candidates. And the prediction is that when we put these two in, they're going to rescue the receptor and make it cortisol specific. So here's the data you've already seen. X likes all three hormones, XY doesn't do anything. When we introduce Z, indeed, it rescues the receptor and gives us a GR, complete GR-like phenotype activated wholly by cortisol. So these seven historical substitutions are sufficient to completely recapitulate the evolution of the new function. We were pretty blown away when that actually worked. Because the two out of the 31 remaining, or 32 remaining, was there was a little bit of a long shot aspect to it, but the prediction from the structure and the phylogenetics was right. But it raises a new problem. How do you get to XYZ if you can't go through XY, right? So what happens if you put Z in first? Well, Z, like the interaction between the two substitutions that we started with in group X, is functionally close to neutral. It has almost no effect on the function of the receptor. But once you have Z present, it allows the receptor to tolerate introduction of group Y and the switching of function that Y triggers. So we call these substitutions, we call group Z permissive, because they have no apparent change in function, but they are required for the receptor to tolerate later function switching mutations. So if we put all this on a depiction of sequence space, now this is a reduced version of sequence space where X, Y, and Z each have one dimension. The real space is seven dimensional. So we're thinking of X, Y, and Z as indivisible sets here. The actual space is more complicated. But it does tell us something about the way epistasis structures the trajectory of evolution. So we start with an ancestral GR1 that's sensitive to all three hormones and end up with ancestral GR2 with seven substitutions, capital X, Y, Z, that is only cortisol specific. Well, how can we get there? Well, there are two ways we can start. We can introduce group X first, which switches the preference, or we can introduce Z first, which is permissive in the sense that it's basically neutral. And once Z is present, then we have lots of things that can happen. So what we can't do first is introduce Y first, because Y on its own is a dead receptor. Once we have X and Z, you can't introduce Y still, because you have to have both X and Z for Y to be tolerated. I didn't show you those experiments, but we did all of these combinations. So once you're at X or Z, the only place you can go is here. But once you're here, Y can now be tolerated, and it's Y that shifts the function to give you the completely optimized phenotype. So epistasis rules out certain evolutionary pathways through sequence space, but permissive mutation creates ridges through space which allows otherwise intolerable mutations to be assembled in combinations that give you new functions.
Have you looked at any of the, any of the other 29 and how they alter function?
Yes. And I'll show you that. That's the next chapter. That's the last chapter.
So when you call these pathways neutral steps, I mean, to what extent should I take that literally? I mean, could there be polymorphism, for example, or variation that actually shows that they're neutral? Like, or is that a...
So Z is variable in all of the MRs and unduplicated CRs. If you look at the sequences of extant members of the family that do not have Y, Z is variable. But everybody who has Y also has Z.
Right, so that supports your notion of a neutral step, that it's variable as long as you don't have Y.
I think so.
Okay.
really what you mean when you say functionally neutral. It's functionally neutral with respect to the assay you're performing.
That's right.
So it could be that these changes were driven by selection for something else. Or for something I mean, selection could be far more sensitive than your assay, so it could easily be that these are distinguishable to selection, so.
That's definitely right. So we can't rule out the possibility that there's some small selective effect of those small, tiny changes in function, or that there's some other aspect of function that would have a selective effect that we don't know what it is. How do we have no evidence for it?
Yeah.
So as far as we can tell, it's neutral, but we can't rule out the possibility of a weak selective effect. Last chapter. Now that we know that we can recapitulate the evolution of the new function with seven historical substitutions, we wanted to know if we could then reverse the evolution of the GR phenotype by reversing those same substitutions. So this gets at a long-standing issue in evolutionary biology about the reversibility of the evolutionary process. So in 1890, Louis Dolo, a Belgian paleontologist, came up with what's known as Dolo's Law, which said evolution never returns to a complex ancestral state. That a complex state, once lost or modified, cannot be regained in the same form. This is a way of asking how much history matters to the outcome of evolution. If evolution is irreversible, that implies that a given adaptive peak can only be accessed from certain places in phenotype space. And the outcome of evolution, therefore, depends on where you are at any one moment. On the other hand, if evolution is readily reversible and ancestral states can easily be regained, then this would imply that selection has the power to achieve an optimum irrespective of present state or of history. This is why this has been such a debated issue. So we want to know if we can get from ancestral GR2 backwards to the ancestral GR1 phenotype, the promiscuous receptor, by reversing those seven key substitutions. The difference here is that there are these 29 others that have also changed between GR1 and GR2. Right? So if we can reverse ancestral the ancestral GR2 in that background to the ancestral function. So when we do that experiment, we get, again, an almost completely dead receptor. When we return big XYZ to its ancestral little XYZ state, the receptor is not returned to the ancestral function, and in fact, it's terrible. It's a terrible activator. And in fact, any combination that has X, those two key substitutions, reversed, is non-functional. So that implies that these two key substitutions cannot be reversed in the ancestral GR2 background. That there was sort of an evolutionary ratchet, that there were additional restrictive substitutions during this period that prevent reversal of X to its ancestral state. So we wanted to identify what those are. They have to be among those 29 others. They must have additional changes here, must have sort of burned the bridge behind the protein as it evolved and kept it from going backwards by reversal of those key mutations. So to identify those, we looked at the 29 others, and we used the same approach, phylogeny and structure. We started by reasoning that states that are required for the ancestral function should be conserved in all of the present-day proteins that retain that function. So we're looking for sites that are conserved among all of the MRs but are variable among the genomes. And there were a number of these. There are actually 10 of them. Five of them are shown here because those are the five that on the structure look like good candidates. These five are shown in purple here, and they were selected from among the 10 because they appear to stabilize helix 7 in the ancestral conformation, and this is the helix they got unlocked. This is the one that's moved by X. So we're looking for states that seem to contribute to the stability of the receptor when it's got the ancestral states for X. And specifically, you've got these two which interact in a pair, which forms a nice stabilizing pi stack, which contributes to the stability of this helix and also the helix that buttresses it in the back. Then you've got this pair right here, which makes this nice packing interaction between the repositioned helix and the helix next to it. And then finally, you've got the one down here, which is right next to the S106P, and that makes room for this loop to be closer to this helix. So all of these seem like, if you put in the GR-like state here, that they would destabilize the ancestral conformation. So we hypothesized that if we switch those back to the ancestral state, then the receptor will be able to tolerate the functionally important ones. So here's the dead receptor. We're going to hypothesize that these other ones, which we call group W, those five, are going to rescue the receptor and now restore the promiscuous ancestral phenotype. So here's the experiment, and it did it perfectly. So this restores the ancestral receptor. It prefers aldosterone to cortisol. It's also a good DOC receptor. DOC didn't come all the way back. But this is this indicates that these reversing these five substitutions on top of the seven crucial ones is sufficient to open up the path backwards and allow the ancestral sequence structure and function to be restored. So we call these restrictive substitutions, so being a parent opposite of permissive is restrictive. And this indicates that the evolution of these little W sites to big W in this background prevent reversal because they weaken the foundation for the ancestral structure and its function. Now we tried all of these individually. All five make a contribution. So Y107A partially rescues the receptor and restores the ancestral phenotype. This pair here, this is the two that were on, this one is on helix 7, this is right across from it. These also contribute, but when you do them individually, they don't contribute. You need both of them together. And this pair also makes a contribution, but they have to be together. So all five of them belong in this group W as restrictive substitutions that prevent reversal. Now notice the strong hypostatic effect here. So this table shows you the effect of reversing big W to little W in all of the possible combinations of X, Y, Z. And so each shaded pair is one background with W switched from the derived back to the ancestral state. And you can see that when you restore W to its ancestral state, that improves function only when X has already been restored. So its W is deleterious when it comes first. And in fact, it doesn't do anything, either dead receptors anyway, in these backgrounds, when X is in its derived state. Here it has a slightly deleterious effect on the sensitivity of the receptor. It's only once little X is in place, like here, that W allows the ancestral function to be restored, the multifunctional phenotype, here and here in the little X background. But little X is deleterious whenever W has not already been reversed. That's the idea of being permissive. And W is deleterious, or close to neutral, as in this case, unless X is present. So to go backwards, you need both of these. You also need one and Z, ultimately. But even if you had a situation where the ancestral function is being selected for, there would be no selection for little X or little W on their own. So here is the cube, now the hypercube, for X, Y, Z, and W. And we did all of these experiments. Now this is actually 12-dimensional space instead of a 4-dimensional space, but we didn't break up the sets. So the sets are indivisible. The idea here is that we're trying to go from ancestral GR2, with big X, Y, Z, and W to ancestral GR1 here. This is activated only by cortisol. This is activated by all three. It's a complicated diagram, but the important thing to notice is that non-functional steps that involve going through a non-functional intermediate are red, and steps that involve going through a functional intermediate are black. There is a very limited number of steps that will get, of trajectories that will get you from here to here. The vast majority of pathways are forbidden because of these epistatic interactions. The only way to do it is to have Y get reversed first, which doesn't improve the function. It's basically neutral. And then once you have this, then you can start reversing the other ones. But none of these actually restore the ancestral function until you have the whole thing together. So even under selection for a reversal, the probability of tracing a pathway like that is vanishingly low. And that is the reason why evolution is essentially irreversible. There is a pathway backwards, but the probability of it being taken is extremely low.
Sorry.
Yeah.
But you can think of other ways, perhaps there are ways to pick up the current token and go back to ancestral function, which wouldn't be the ancestral token, but the ancestral function. You can tell me the fine reversibility.
Right. So this is an important part of this whole Dolo reversibility thing. Are you going back to a similar phenotype with a similar basis, or is it almost like a parallel evolution of a similar phenotype with a different basis? So you would have to find some other way of accommodating aldosterone and DOC, of stabilizing the receptor that doesn't involve repositioning of that helix back to its original place, where you don't need that hydrogen bond to the 17. So it might be possible to engineer a promiscuous receptor from the ancestral GR2 background without these changes, but it would not be returning to the ancestral state. It would be a different state. Now finally, let's ask why those restrictive substitutions evolved in the first place. So now we're going to talk about forward evolution of these group Ws from the ancestral state. We introduced big W into the ancestral GR1 in various combinations of X, Y, and Z. And we find that these changes had weak or no effect on the function of the receptor when they occurred. So if W comes first, these are slightly different axes, so you've got to move them in your mind. But it had, when this is the slide that I just made, and it's upside down. This should be here, and this should be here. So this is the ancestral state, and it's going from here to here. And you can see that it has a mildly deleterious effect on function. It moves the dose response curves to the right a little bit. In some other backgrounds, however, it has little or no effect on receptor function. And most importantly, once big X has been changed, it actually improves cortisol specificity. Same in this background, improves cortisol specificity. And in this background, improves cortisol specificity. So there are two possibilities then. These W mutations may have occurred neutrally. They may have been permissive in reverse, no effect on function, but they prevent going back. Or they may have been involved in optimizing the derived function, depending on whether they came first or second. In this sense, we can say that the infrastructure for the ancestral function degraded either neutrally or as a byproduct of optimization of the derived function. So one way of saying this is that the evolution of the new function destroyed the conditions required for the ancestral function, either because the ancestral function was not under selection anymore, or more actively, because of selection for the derived function, that destroys the conditions to regain the ancestral function. So this indicates that there's something like a molecular Dolo's law for proteins, that evolution is expected to be essentially irreversible whenever the structural basis of protein function is complex, meaning there's enough epistasis that there are restrictive substitutions that prevent going backwards unless a significant number of substitutions is reversed. And in that sense, evolution is fundamentally historical. Williamson said, referred to this as the historicity of evolution. That selection is not all powerful, but the trajectory that evolution takes through through the vast number of possibilities determines the outcome that will occur at any point in time. So if we take this whole thing and we knit this together into one story and one figure, we start with an aldosterone-sensitive ancestor more than 470 million years ago in the ancestor of all vertebrates. It's activated by DOC. It has the potential to be activated by LDO, but LDO is not present yet. You have a gene duplication that now gives you two functionally identical receptors. Then in this, here's the key interval in the new function of the GR evolves. X and Z occur, they must occur before Y and W because these would be non-functional combinations. So X and Z occur, followed by W and Y, now giving you a cortisol-specific receptor and an ancestral receptor maintaining the ancestral phenotype. And W along the way keeps the receptor from moving backwards. And finally, much later, in the tetrapod lineage alone, aldosterone synthesis evolves, giving us the endocrine system we have today of a cortisol-specific GR and an aldosterone-sensitive mammal. So in conclusion, if we think about the ideas that we started off with, we can say that new molecular interactions evolve by a process of molecular exploitation, where old molecules are recruited into new partnerships. And those old molecules had different functions. This process of exploitation is greatly facilitated by promiscuity in the protein, its ability to bind partners that are not yet present due to a certain amount of structural wiggle room. What about adaptation? Well, it appears to have occurred in this case by a combination of mutations of large and small effects. We might think of this as large effect mutations like group X moving us from one peak to another, and smaller effect mutations, group Y, optimizing the function up to the peak. Epistasis played a crucial role in the evolution of this family, indicating a strong role for contingency rather than determinism in the outcome of evolution. So these permissive mutations, functionally neutral changes that allow the protein to tolerate function switching mutations, create ridges to new functions. So that complexity problem we started with, how do you get co-adapted complexes of multiple substitutions, there are ridges that get you from one place to the next. However, if those permissive changes are truly neutral, this introduces a great degree of contingency into the evolutionary process. Suppose we could rewind the tape and let history run from the time of ancestral GR1. If they are neutral, the chances that these permissive mutations would occur again is vanishingly low. And if that's true, then the new function would not be able to evolve because the ridge would have been missed. In that sense, the biology that we have today is one of many possible rolls of the dice. Certainly something else would have adapted, but this specific adapted form that we have is the result of relatively low probability events that might not be repeated. This same contingency makes protein evolution virtually irreversible, and I just said that. I showed you the structural mechanisms for evolving a new function, that new specificity seems to involve destabilizing the complex between receptor and ligand, and then restoring sensitivity with specific new interactions with one ligand over the others. And finally, I hope I've shown you some ways that the functional synthesis of molecular biology with evolutionary and computational analysis can give us insight into the mechanisms and dynamics of the evolutionary process, and also give us decisive inference that adds both depth and strength to conclusions that would otherwise have been more speculative if they were only based on computational analysis. So, let me thank the people who did the work. In particular, I need to thank Jamie Bridgham, who's a senior research associate in the lab who did almost all of the work on the ancestral receptors. Brian Kolachowski is a computational biologist in the lab who did a lot of software development. And this is Sean Carroll, Sean M. Carroll, who's a grad student in my lab, who did the work on the SCATE GR and MR. And I also need to thank Eric in particular, our collaborator on structural biology. And I'd like to thank you. It's been fun being here.
One of your conclusions was that you demonstrated the origin, molecular origin of a new function, but mostly it's the increased specificity, right? I mean, compared to the ancestral promiscuous function. And so isn't the first promiscuous protein, isn't that really the origin of the function? And so, I mean, to me, that's just as interesting why that happened.
The GR's function is to be a cortisol receptor that's not activated by those other hormones.
Oh, right.
So there's sort of a semantic thing of how you define the function, and is this a loss of function, partitioning loss of function rather than a change in function. It depends on how you define it, but it's a physiologically important change in function. Where the sensitivity to all three hormones came from in the first place is a really interesting question, and we're working on that as well. That's the next receptor deeper in the family.
And we were talking a little bit at the break about that, but you said you sort of think that that's may turn out to be fairly general, that when functions first arise, they're fairly promiscuous and then specialized. But what's to say that the origin, you know, since there are proteins that now are specialized, why not have the origin of that specialized? What is the sort of historicity of that generality? You know, why would you expect the origins of functional proteins to be promiscuous versus specialized if both exist?
That's a really good question. So in this family, let me see, one major switch in function, sort of a wholesale switch where you lose sensitivity to an ancestral hormone and gain sensitivity to a whole new group of hormones. That happens once, and then most of the rest of the diversification is lost in repeated losses at different places in the tree for different hormones that the ancestor was sensitive to. So in this family, at least, it does appear that that's the pattern. If I wanted to explain why that's the pattern, this is sort of hand-wavy teleological explanation, but I think that it's kind of an anti-teleological explanation. But I think that the answer would be that receptors are only as specific at any point in time as they need to be. Without selection pressure not to recognize a certain hormone or groups of hormones, then that's what you'll get. It will discriminate to the extent that is necessary to maintain the integrity of the signaling processes in the organism, which is why, for instance, our hormone receptors are sensitive to all sorts of pollutants that are in the environment now. They're produced pesticides and industrial chemicals produced by industry starting in 1940 or 1950 because the receptors had never seen those before. So that's my guess.
So sort of related to that, one other thing I was thinking about is to what extent can you move up to the organismal functions related to these in evolutionary terms? What are the implications for the organismal functions, or is that just too complicated to start to address?
I wish we could do that. So that gets at the limits of this ancestral reconstruction strategy. So it would be great if we could ask the question, when did the GR's role in stress response, first of all? Or when did the ER's role in regulating the development of the mammary gland evolve? to answer that question using this approach, I would have to be able to resurrect the ancestral organism, the ancestral vertebrate, which we obviously can't do because that requires the whole system to experiment with. You need the ancestral receptor and you need the rest of the organism. You might be able to break it down to specific functions, like when does the ancestral receptor gain the ability to regulate this target gene with this kind of promoter on. And that would be a really interesting thing to do. Gunter Wagner did something similar to that in a recent paper in PNAS on the evolution of Hox genes under prolactin control. That's a really nice paper to look at. But it's not the whole organism, it's getting more towards the system, the cellular system.
So you discussed a particular plausible pathway to reach this kind of complex evolutionary process. Can you comment on how much faith do you have in this particular process you described? Is there a way to kind of evaluate its probability, its likelihood compared to all the other vast amount of possible pathways?
So there are a certain group of historical substitutions that did happen. So these are the changes that happened. That's one advantage of this sort of approach over protein evolution or directed evolution experiments, where you do selection in the lab and you try to make a new function, but the substitutions you end up with may not be historical ones. These are the ones that happen. So then the question is, which of the many possible orders are possible? And I think what we've shown is that there are a large number of those possible pathways that are very unlikely. How many are left in the set of plausible ones? I don't know exactly. We would have to break open those sets and do all of the combinations, and we haven't done that. But so I guess the conclusion goes as far as a significant number are unlikely. I can't tell you. I know that there's more than one that's plausible because there are several that go through exclusively functional mediators. And it's impossible to distinguish between among those several. Thanks.